docket today. 24-50627, Space Exploration Technologies Corporation v. National Labor Relations Board. So, Mr. Boehm, did I pronounce that right? BEM. Apologies. Welcome. Good afternoon. Take it away.
And I'm going to be reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Before I begin my presentation of the case, I wanted to address the change of circumstances occasioned by the president's removal of member Wilcox from the board. The president's removal of former member Wilcox should result in the denial of the employer's preliminary injunction motions as they relate to removability of board members without regard to the likelihood of success on the merits. Irreparable harm here, if it ever existed at all, is no longer sufficiently imminent and certain to warrant the exercise of extraordinary preliminary injunction power. The NLRB has recognized that it currently lacks a quorum as well. Consequently, the board, as currently constituted, cannot issue a final decision in any of these employers' cases. Under New Process Steel versus NLRB, that's reported at 560 U.S. 674, 2010. There's no longer any need to proceed with these cases on an accelerated preliminary injunction timetable. Furthermore, the president's removal of member Wilcox diminishes, if not wholly eliminates, the employer's ability to show causal harm arising from the removal restrictions. Under this court's decision in CFSA, removal restrictions challenges must show, among other things, that the official with removal authority had a perceived inability to remove the actor due to the infirm provision that refers to the president's perceived inability. An effectuated removal, as we've had here, is inconsistent with such a perceived inability to remove. If there's no questions, I'll proceed to the... In each case below, the district court enjoined an unfair labor practice hearing before the NLRB because of removal restrictions for agency officials, despite the fact that no party can show, as it must under Supreme Court and Fifth Circuit law, that it would actually be harmed in any way by those removal protections. The injunctive relief ordered by these courts is also jurisdictionally barred by an act of Congress. In the Norris LaGuardia Act, Congress broadly divested federal courts of jurisdiction to issue injunctions in cases involving or growing out of labor disputes, and no exception applies here. Norris LaGuardia also requires employers to engage in every reasonable effort to resolve a labor dispute and to comply with applicable laws before seeking an injunction. But none have done so here. The injunctions below interfere with employees in their efforts to vindicate key labor rights, which are protected by two federal statutes, the Norris LaGuardia Act and the National Labor Relations Act. And that is beyond the congressionally limited power of those courts. On the merits, the injunctions were grounded in legal error because each employer's claims before this court fail on simple causation grounds. No employer has made any effort to show how the challenged officer tenure protections would make any difference in the enjoined proceedings. Irreparable harm, the second injunction factor, must be satisfied in this court by independent proof or no injunction may issue. Instead of such proof, however, we were offered conjecture and complaints related to the burdens of litigation, which as a matter of law are not irreparable. Nor has any employer met its burden to show inadequacy of legal remedies like a declaratory judgment or severance that would adequately remedy their alleged injuries, as they must. And no party can meet the demanding burden to show that the harm visited by these injunctions on the public and the employees, both their employees and employees generally, are outweighed by the minimal harm that would be imposed by them having to attend or participate in an administrative hearing. Considering the public interest as reflected in two federal statutes and the congressional policy of those statutes, which protect employees' fundamental rights to labor activity and also protect commerce from injury in the case of the National Labor Relations Act, the court has to weigh those interests as reflected by Congress. And, you know, in a in a way that respects both employees' rights and the government's interest in enforcing the law. The district courts below, with respect to the equities, incorrectly relied on First Amendment case law and privacy case law that essentially collapsed the four injunction factors into one, which was impermissible. All of these are errors dictated with reversal.
Yes, Mr. Beam, on the irreparable harm point, so I hear what you're saying with respect to Collins. I take this, the Collins argument is, well, even assuming there's an unconstitutional removal restriction on the ALJ, you have to point to some harm that flows from that. I take that to be the Collins argument. You're relying on our Collins case.
There are three factors to Collins. There's the inability, the inability, which I addressed in my remarks. But there's also a nexus requirement.
I guess I'm referring to the nexus requirement. So if you could help me understand, maybe it's tension, maybe it's just a different line of cases. When you look at Axon, where Axon is talking about the harm of being subjected to a proceeding that is being run by someone that's not, you know, that doesn't have the right removal protections and all that. So I take that to be the Axon argument, and you're making the Collins argument. So help me understand, why would I look to Collins as opposed to Axon when we're talking about this?
Axon didn't purport to say anything about irreparable harm or injunctive remedies. Axon was strictly a case about subject matter jurisdiction in federal courts for collateral attacks on certain types of agency actions.
Right, but it did talk about the harm of being subjected to an unconstitutional proceeding, right?
Harm as it relates to an injury to support the court's jurisdiction. The loss of a peppercorn can be an injury sufficient to confer standing, but that doesn't mean it justifies an injunction.
If we were to go with the Collins sort of nexus requirement, how would one ever show that kind of nexus in a case of this nature, where you're saying, well, I'm trying to enjoin the proceeding because of the unconstitutional removal protections on the ALJ, the allegedly unconstitutional removal protections. How would you ever show the nexus that you think Collins requires?
I think the court in Collins laid it out. You would have a statement by the president that they were dissatisfied with the performance or the decisions of that decision maker, and you would have a perceived inability to remove that officer, and you would have a nexus that related those facts to the facts before.
Yeah, I guess I'm having trouble seeing how that would practically work in the context of an ALJ. I mean, the idea is that by virtue of their removal restrictions, all the ALJs are unconstitutional. So how would you show as a practical matter what you say is required here?
So causal harm, I guess this came up in the context of irreparable harm, but it's actually an element of the cause of action. So they can't compete on the merits on it either if they can't establish But I think the standard is a high one, and that's deliberate. The court wanted people to show concrete effects on their actual situation, as opposed to alleging broadly that ALJs can't be trusted to adjudicate their proceeding. You mentioned ALJs, so that's why I'm...
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, I think if you had you asked for an example, a hypothetical, if you had an ALJ, for instance, who had made statements showing evident bias, and those were reported to the president, and he expressed displeasure, and that bias related to the issue before the ALJ, that would satisfy the standard.
Okay, you'd have to show some causal harm as to a particular ALJ that was assigned to hear your proceeding?
I think that's correct. I think that's, the Sixth Circuit suggested that in Calcutt, and this court's decision in CFSA agreed with that reasoning.
Okay, thank you.
So I'm going to address the Norris LaGuardia Act because it's a threshold jurisdictional issue, at least as relates to the injunctive. I'm sorry, Mr. Judge Willett, did you have a question?
Nope.
Because it's a threshold issue with respect to the court's injunctive powers. The appellees here have tried to complicate the import of this statute, but it's a very simple statute. It begins with Section 101 of Title 29, which states, and I'm paraphrasing, no court of the United States may issue an injunction in any case involving or growing out of a labor dispute in contrary to the policy set forth in Section 102. And in Section 102, the policy statement lays out the rights of employees to collective bargaining, to self-organization, to engage in other activities for mutual aid and protection, which are the same rights guaranteed by the National Labor Relations Act. The Supreme Court in Jones and Laughlin Steel, the case that upheld the National Labor Relations Act, described these rights as fundamental. The injunctions in this case prevent employees from vindicating those rights in the only statutory form in which they can do so. There's no private cause of action under the NLRA. The only way they could vindicate their rights outside of these types of proceedings is through self-help, strikes, picketing, the very types of things that Congress were trying to curtail or reduce, the types of strife that Congress was trying to reduce in enacting the National Labor Relations Act. The appellees largely say that this case is not a labor dispute because they're raising constitutional claims. But that's not what the standard is. The North LaGuardia Act applies to any case that involves or grows out of a labor dispute, and the statute helpfully includes a definition, which we paraphrase or which we excerpted in our brief. And ignoring the sort of disjunctive clauses that the appellees focus on, it's clear that any dispute regarding terms and conditions of employment between one or more employers and one or more employees qualifies as a labor dispute. And if a case involves a labor dispute, it doesn't have to be a labor dispute. The cases are very clear on that. Injunctive remedies are prohibited.
What's your best case for the proposition that an constitutional objection to the structure of the adjudicatory process here arises out of a labor dispute under the Norris LaGuardia Act? I take it that's the distinction the other side is making.
They do rely on both the structure or the fact that they're challenging the labor statute itself. Mm-hmm. Was one of their arguments. And I think the Trainman case, the railroad Trainman case, where the employees thought, or the employers didn't believe they were required to participate in the dispute, was a case where the Supreme Court said that didn't matter. You still have to exhaust those procedures before you can try to obtain an injunction. I would also say that the Armco case involved constitutional claims, and there it was under Section 1983. But the Sixth Circuit said it didn't matter. It didn't matter that the union wasn't bound by the injunction, and it didn't matter that the claims were not themselves a labor dispute.
Thank you.
Just in terms of the applicability of this statute, also the plain language of the statute is in itself sufficient to apply it here. The argument of the employers would require believing that a unfair labor practice proceeding brought by, initiated by a charge filed by employees against an employer is not a labor dispute that this case grows out of, and that can't be. Words don't have meaning anymore if that's true. I would also note that with regard to the requirement that the parties exhaust proceedings before seeking an injunction, this court's decision in Cochran actually leaves open the idea that where exhaustion is a potential barrier for relief, even if Congress hasn't barred pre-enforcement challenges, that may still be a barrier to the court exercising jurisdiction. So I think those are consistent. I'll proceed to the merits. Under this court's decisions in CFSA and Collins v. Department of Treasury, the three requirements I had mentioned earlier for officer removal apply regardless of prospective or retrospective relief being sought. And the appellees reliance on an earlier decision, Cochran, is of no avail because that case was earlier in time, and this court's subsequent decisions in CFSA and Collins established what needs to be shown to make out a case for an officer removal protection. The employers contend these requirements don't apply because they are seeking prospective relief or relief in the form of an injunction. But as I mentioned earlier, these are elements of a cause of action. And in fact, in CFSA, this court affirmed a 12B6 dismissal for failing to state a claim because these factors weren't satisfied. I'll return to your earlier question about Axon. I view, as I said, Axon a case about the subject matter jurisdiction of federal courts. It opens to the door to the courthouse, but it doesn't say anything about what you have to prove once you get inside. So, and it doesn't purport to. I would also note that Collins v. Yellen was decided after Axon. They were both authored by Justice Kagan. And there was no indication that Collins v. Yellen called into question, or that Axon called into question anything that had been decided in Collins. So this court's not free to infer that the holding in Collins is, you know, not valid or not doesn't control this case anymore. And likewise, this court's decision in Cochran, the sole issue, that was the words of this court, was the jurisdiction of the court. I guess I'll return to irreparable harm. First of all, I think I had alluded to before, if there's no showing of causal harm, there's certainly no showing of irreparable harm. So if there's, they both can't succeed on the merits and they can't establish irreparable harm necessary for an injunction. And as Justice Thomas explained in his concurrence in Collins v. Yellen, that an improper or excessive removal protection does not call into question the validity of the actions of an actor. With respect to the burdens that they've relied on to establish irreparable harm, I see them as, and they're perhaps a little different in the different cases, but they primarily rely on Axon as a magic irreparable harm machine, but it doesn't purport to do that, and doing so would negate the other requirements you have to show for irreparable harm, namely that an injury be certainly impending. The other sort of more practical, real world, I suppose you could say, things that they've pointed to are things like diversion of resources, litigation costs, distraction in their operations. And these things are incident to any sort of litigation. The Supreme Court has repeatedly held in FTC versus Standard Oil of California, and I believe Bannercraft, Renegotiation Board versus Bannercraft Clothing Company, that these sorts of injuries are not irreparable harm as a matter of law. And in fact, then there's a 1937 case of the Fifth Circuit, Bradley Lumber, where they said that this was part of the social burden of living under government. Even if it stirs up some feeling among employees, it doesn't, it's not the irreparable harm that equity will interfere to stop. I think there was also a mention of reputational injury occasioned by these proceedings. That's foreclosed by the Supreme Court's holding in Sampson v. Murray, which said that having to appear in a government proceeding was not irreparable harm for the purposes of an injunction. With respect to the constitutional nature of the injury, as I alluded to before, First Amendment cases are special, and I think it's not that there's a hierarchy of constitutional rights, but the nature of the injury in First Amendment cases is often one of self-censorship. So as a practical matter, the injury can't be remedied after the fact through monetary damages. The same is true of certain privacy interests that have been adjudicated by courts. Once the privacy is invaded, you can't unring the bell, as it were. The basis for injunctive relief, both in this court and before the Supreme Court, has always been the inadequacy of legal remedies. It is the burden of the plaintiff in an injunction case to show that legal remedies are inadequate, and they have not even tried to do so here. There was some discussion that the government had waived this argument by not asserting the ways in which a statute could be severed to accommodate their claims, but the burden is on them to show inadequacy of legal remedies. So, and I would note, when the Supreme Court has been faced with this issue of removal restrictions, both in the Celia Law and Free Enterprise Fund, severance was the remedy that was ordered in those cases. And how the statute should be severed. I would also note that the National Labor Relations Act itself has an explicit severability provision, so it's not as if we have to guess what Congress would have preferred here. And how the statute should be severed is an issue for the trial court that should be decided on the basis of a factual record. I'll move on to the equities. Both of the statutes that are implicated here, the NLRA and Norris LaGuardia, came in the face of decades of tumultuous labor unrest and economic hardship. Congress created a system of industrial peace through law to try to resolve that conflict. That system served our nation for about 90 years. And each of these appellees seeks an order that would upend that system and risk sending us back to those days. And the reason it believes it's entitled to do this is because it thinks it shouldn't have to participate in a agency proceeding. As I think I may have mentioned before, congressional policy is part of the public interest here. Congress has set forth its policy in both of these statutes to protect what the Supreme Court called fundamental rights to self-organization and collective bargaining and other mutual aid and protection. But also to protect commerce from injury. Equity also has to consider the interests of people who are not before the court. So there are the actual employees affected by these individual cases, and their interests are significant. As I mentioned before, there's no other forum in which they can adjudicate these rights. And I think it is at least one appellee has argued that the statute can't be severed. That would forever foreclose any day in court for these employees. With respect to the broader public interest of employees and employers and unions, they rely on this statute to regulate their economic relationships. And these types of orders call into question the validity of the law that governs those relationships. And finally, the government itself has an interest in being able to effectively adjudicate these disputes. At least in the preliminary injunction posture, courts shouldn't presume that there's no interest of the government of enforcing a statute because its constitutionality is questioned. And the orders that are being sought here would effectively put on hold proceedings where memories are likely to fade, witnesses might be scattered to the four winds, documents could be destroyed or data lost. So the equities do not favor an injunction. And if there are no more questions.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And we'll see you back on rebuttal. So obviously these are consolidated cases. So we're first gonna hear from Mr. Cox.
Yes, Your Honor.
Of Energy Transfer.
Yes.
Okay.
May it please the court, Trevor Cox from Hunt and Andrews Kurth, along with co-counsel, I'm pleased to represent the appellees in this consolidated case. My colleague will address the merits of the appeal, but I will address the North LaGuardia Act threshold question that the board has sought to introduce on appeal, and the board's apparent position that North LaGuardia prevents any federal court from ever enjoining it, even when constitutional rights are allegedly being violated. We've internally allocated 10 minutes for this issue, but when the court becomes satisfied on it, I'm happy to step aside and see any remaining time. Your Honors, I have two main points I'd like to focus on. First, why the board cannot raise the North LaGuardia Act issue at this late date. And second, even if the board could raise the issue now, the board is wrong that the anti-injunction language stands in the way of relief for three reasons. This case does not involve or grow out of a labor dispute under 113A. The government is not a person within the meaning of the Act, 113B, and the case does not concern one of the categories of conduct in Section 104 that courts are sometimes prohibited from enjoining. So first, the board did not raise below the anti-injunction argument, and commendably they concede in their opening brief at page 18, note 8. So therefore, it's forfeited the issue. Now, the board says, wait a minute, the statute uses the term jurisdiction in describing the court's power, and that can never be waived. But that's just not so. It's true that subject matter jurisdiction cannot be waived, and challenges to a court's power to hear a case can be raised at any time, but that's not what we have here. Clearly, district courts do possess the authority and jurisdiction to enter injunctive relief in certain situations, even in labor disputes. That's apparent from the statute and also from the case law. But there's a difference between subject matter jurisdiction and the power to grant certain remedial relief. SpaceX made that point with a couple of cases in its brief at page 55, including the Reed-Elsevier case. But citing Reed, the Supreme Court has since made that even clearer in a case a couple of years ago called Biden v. Texas, which is 597 U.S. 785. The court said there, the question whether a court has jurisdiction to grant a particular remedy is different from the question whether it has subject matter jurisdiction over a particular class of claims. That's at page 801. So objections to the assertion of that kind of jurisdiction can be forfeited, and that's what happened here. So moving on to the reasons why the North LaGuardia argument fails. This is first not a case that falls within the scope of the Act's anti-injunction language. First, the terms of the statute expressly limit its application to cases that, quote, involve or grow out of a labor dispute. And we know that this is not such a case because the statute expressly defines when a case involves or grows out of a labor dispute. Section 113 says, a case shall be held to involve or grow out of a labor dispute when the case involves persons who are engaged in the same industry, trade, craft, or occupation, have direct or indirect interest therein, or who are employees of the same employer, or who are members of the same or an affiliated organization of employers or employees. None of those criteria fit here. This is a case between an administrative agency and a regulated entity. The Supreme Court has said that the critical element in determining whether the provisions of the Act apply is whether the employer-employee relationship is the matrix of the controversy. And this court has held in Wooten versus Oler, cited in our brief, that the dispute involved terms and conditions of employment only indirectly, and then not between parties to such employment. Mr. Bem could not cite a case where a case like this would be subject to that provision. He did cite the Armco case, but that case actually said, if a constitutional right is violated in a labor dispute between a municipal government and its employee, an injunction issued against the municipality in such circumstances does not interfere with the policy aims at of North LaGuardia. That's at 280 F3rd at 680. And the board's argument has no limiting principle. If labor dispute concerns any case tangentially related to a case between employees and employers, then everything the board does would fall outside the Act's anti-injunction provision. No court could ever enjoin the board, even when it's violating constitutional rights, as alleged here, and that just can't be right. Second, we know that the Act doesn't apply because it applies only to persons as defined in the Act, and persons must be involved on both sides of the case, and defendants here are not persons. Section 113B provides that a person or association shall be held to be a person participating in or interested in a labor dispute only if that person or organization, again, is engaged in the same industry, trade, craft, or occupation, has a direct or indirect interest therein, is a member, officer, or agent of any association, et cetera, et cetera. But the Supreme Court has made clear that the U.S. is not a person for purposes of the North LaGuardia Act. It made that clear in 1947 in United States versus United Mine Workers of America, where it said the act does not define persons, but in common usage that term does not include the sovereign. And that was in the context of a decision where the U.S. was an employer. So even closer to the kinds of acts that the conduct that the NLGA might be involved with. But we don't even have that here. Again, the Wooten case, consistent with United Mine Workers of America, found that the North LaGuardia Act did not deprive the court of jurisdiction to enjoin a sheriff from preventing a plaintiff from picketing because the definition of person would not include peace officers. So in any event, defendants don't fit the criteria under 113B that I listed before. Third, there's Section 4 of the Act, which is a section that identifies the 9 categories of employee conduct during labor disputes that courts are not permitted to enjoin. That is an exclusive list, as this court found in Scott versus Moore back in 1981, and a suit challenging the constitutionality of agency proceedings does not appear on that list. So all of these considerations demonstrate that a case like this, challenging government proceedings, not the terms of the relationship between employer and employee, fall outside of the scope of the anti-injunction provision. And that's not surprising given the purpose of the North LaGuardia Act. So however you look at it, the provision does not apply. I want to address a couple arguments that Mr. Bem made. First, about exhaustion, that the board has to go through some sort of process to resolve their differences. Now, usually you have to resolve the differences with employees, but we don't have employees involved in this action, so it doesn't really make sense under their theory that an employer would have to participate in unconstitutional proceedings in order to challenge being subjected to unconstitutional proceedings. That's sort of the point that I think my colleague is going to get into as well. They also say on brief that there's no, that North LaGuardia doesn't apply here because, that there's no federal statute that requires reconciling with the NLGA to permit an exception. But it's unclear why a challenge regarding the constitutionality of proceedings is entitled to less deference than a federal statute that would need reconciling. The principle is that parties can sue to vindicate constitutional rights, and North LaGuardia should not stand in the way. The board's own cases say that. I cited the Armco case before, which itself relied on a case called Reuter versus Skipper, also cited by the board in their reply brief at pages 10 and 11. And I'll quote from that, where they held that a party could bring a 1983 action to vindicate constitutional rights. And they said, the Ninth Circuit said there, it would be incongruous to read North LaGuardia to preclude equitable relief as a remedy available to the injured party just because the parties are involved in a labor dispute. Our holding does not interfere with the purposes of North LaGuardia. It was intended to protect workers from federal court injunctions. If a constitutional right is violated in a labor dispute between a municipal government and its employee, the Section 1983 claim will invariably be made by the employee, and an injunction issued against the municipality in such circumstances does not interfere with the policy aims of North LaGuardia. So even if the court were to find that North LaGuardia otherwise would apply, it could find that a limited exception applies for the vindication of constitutional rights in this sort of special species of Axon cases like these.
Okay.
Unless the court has further questions, I'll hand it over to my colleague.
Okay, Mr. Cox, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Keneally, who I guess will tackle everything other than North LaGuardia. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please the court. Under this court's precedent, each employer satisfied all 4 factors for a preliminary injunction. And that's why every court in the circuit to address the issue has come to the same conclusion and has enjoined agency proceedings with the flaw at issue here. This court should affirm. While there are several grounds to do so, I think the simplest is this. The board's ALJs are insulated from presidential control through three layers of removal protection, and that violates the Constitution's separation of powers. Under this court's decision in Jarkissi, this interference with the president's ability to supervise and remove agency ALJs is unconstitutional. And under this court's decision in Cochran, sitting en banc, having to undergo proceedings before an unconstitutionally insulated ALJ is a real injury. The Supreme Court unanimously affirmed that conclusion in Axon and held that this exact injury, quote, is impossible to remedy once the proceeding is over. The only way to avoid the injury and avoid the violation of constitutional rights is to block it before it happens, as the district courts here have done. The board has no good response. It barely tries to argue, and it never argued below, that the board's ALJs meaningfully differ from the SEC ALJs in Jarkissi. Instead, the board's main strategy is to manufacture obstacles to this court's ability to grant relief. In other words, even though the structure of the board's proceedings is plainly unconstitutional under Fifth Circuit precedent, there's really nothing a court can do about it. And even though this unconstitutionality inflicts injury under Fifth Circuit precedent, the employer should just accept being injured so that the board can go about its business under its statute. That's not how our constitutional system of government works, because the NLRA doesn't and cannot override the Constitution. I don't want it to get lost in the shuffle how strong a showing we've made here on likelihood of success on the merits. A lot of the board's arguments, especially with respect to the third and fourth factors under the preliminary injunction test, suggest that you can't rule in our favor because then parties that come to court alleging unconstitutionality could shut down the federal government. Well, here, that's just not possible because the most important factor under the preliminary injunction test is likelihood of success on the merits. And if a party has shown that, then the board's objections to having to halt in order for the constitutional problem to be fixed, if it can, aren't a valid objection. Here, Fifth Circuit precedent ensures our success on the ALJ removal protection claim. There's no real dispute that the board's ALJs are unconstitutionally insulated from removal under Jarkissi, because in that case, the court held that ALJs with the SEC are sufficiently important to executing federal law that having multiple layers of removal protection unconstitutionally interferes with the president's ability to control them. And to answer that question, the court turned to the Supreme Court's analysis in Lucia versus SEC, which categorized the SEC's ALJs as inferior officers for purposes of the Appointments Clause in Article 2. That categorization was dispositive for the removability issue under the Jarkissi analysis. Here's what the court said. If SEC ALJs are inferior officers of an executive agency, they are sufficiently important to executing the laws that the Constitution requires that the president be able to exercise authority over their functions. And there's no real dispute that the NLRB ALJs are inferior officers under Lucia because the NLRB itself held as much in 2018 in the WestRock Services case. So in reply, the board tries to distinguish some ways in which NLRB ALJs supposedly have less power under the SEC compared to the SEC ALJs in respect of issuing sanctions and final decisions. We don't think that those attempts to distinguish are factually valid, but the key point here is that it's beside the point because the test under Jarkissi for figuring out whether the removal protections are constitutional is, are these ALJs inferior officers under Lucia, and they clearly are. Let me turn then to Collins, because that is the board's main counterargument on this claim. The board insists that this is a part of the elements of a removal protection claim. They don't have any Supreme Court or Fifth Circuit case law to support that. Obviously, the main case they're relying on is Collins. In Collins, the Supreme Court addressed this causal nexus issue in Section 3C of its opinion when it was time to address the appropriate remedy after the court had already concluded that the challengers were right on the merits in arguing the removal protection's unconstitutionality. Likewise, in Saylor Law, the court resolved the merits of the constitutional issue without asking about compensable harm. Here, too, we succeed on the merits simply because binding precedent dictates that the removal protections are unconstitutional. That's the likelihood of success issue. But even on its own terms, the board's argument is foreclosed by the law of this circuit. In Cochran, the en banc court already recognized that removal protections inflict the injury the employers are asserting here, merely having to undergo proceedings before an unaccountable ALJ, and that this is a serious enough injury to warrant judicial intervention before the end of the agency proceeding. And not only that, the court squarely rejected the same invocation of Collins that the board is now making. In footnote 16 of the en banc court's decision, the court made clear that Collins addresses what it takes to invalidate or void actions that have already been taken by insulated officers, in contrast to seeking an adjudication that's untainted by separation of powers violations in the first instance. We're in that second category. The Supreme Court affirmed the court's view in Axon, recognizing that having to appear before an improperly insulated agency is a here and now injury that is impossible to remedy once the proceeding is over. I think I heard Mr. Bem to say that the constitutional injury, unlike the costs of a proceeding or reputational harm, isn't a real-world injury, but that's flatly inconsistent with the Supreme Court's consistent reference to this separation of powers injury as a here-and-now injury. The NLRB tries to make Axon and Cochran irrelevant by saying they only deal with jurisdiction, but they ignore other Supreme Court decisions that support the same conclusion based on similar logic and endorse granting relief for invalid removal protections. Most notable among these is free enterprise, which I don't think Mr. Bem addressed at all in his opening argument. In free enterprise, the court relied on the fact that appearing before an unaccountable agency officer is a here and now injury to justify affording a judicial remedy in that case. This is very much at the very end of the Supreme Court's majority opinion in free enterprise. The court cites Bauscher versus Sinar for the here and now injury point, and says, as a result, challengers are entitled to declaratory relief sufficient to ensure that the standards to which they are subject will be enforced only by accountable officers. And this court has said similar things in various contexts. In the consumer's research case, the court cited this here and now injury point on Article III standing redressability and highlighted the declaratory relief quote from free enterprise that I just recited. In Judge Oldham's concurring opinion in Cochran, there's an extended discussion of the same passage about an entitlement to declaratory relief under free enterprise. The board relies heavily on CFSA, Community Financial Services Association, but it was not a separation of powers agency proceedings kind of case. It was an unwind agency action after it's taken place case, just like Collins was. And in that context, where you're trying to invalidate or rewind a specific agency action, in that case it was the CFPB's payday lending rule, in that context, that type of relief, unwinding agency action, kind of like setting it aside under the APA, requires the showing that we've talked about today under Collins, the causal nexus standing. Causal nexus showing. But that is not the way that advanced pre-enforcement proceedings under Axon and Cochran should be construed. And I think that the key to that, this goes to a question that Judge Duncan asked, is how could you ever show the Collins injury point? And I think Mr. Bem's response was that if there's specific conduct by the ALJ that shows some sort of impropriety, and then maybe you hook it up to statements that the president has made about wanting to remove the ALJ, that would be enough. But that misconstrues the nature of this injury, as the Supreme Court has consistently explained it. The injury is having to undergo the proceedings in the first place, not the particular harm that the agency proceedings might result in.
Yeah, Mr. Keneally, I understand your argument there. I guess my question was also trying to figure out how that would practically work in the context of an NLRB proceeding. That would you ever be able to make that showing with respect to a particular ALJ? I don't know practically how it works, how the ALJs are assigned, how Do you know ahead of time? When do you find out who the ALJ is? And at that point, you have to figure out whether the, you know, the president wanted to remove. I'm just trying to figure out how it practically would work.
It would be practically very difficult. And it's in the NLRB's control when and whether and how you find out which ALJ is assigned. For instance, in the SpaceX case here, we were told that there was a hearing that was set for October of last year. Obviously, it was enjoined in the end, but we didn't know at that point when we filed suit who the ALJ was. We know that someone's calendar was clear on that day at the NLRB, and there are, I think there are 32 NLRB ALJs, but we didn't know which among them was going to be assigned to our case. So at that point, there is no possible way we could have shown that that particular ALJ would have been someone that the president would have wanted to remove because no one knew who it was. At least we didn't know who it was. And then once you even get within the ALJ proceedings, so you're already subject to the unconstitutional, to the constitutional harm because the ALJ is taking actions now. ALJ hearings are not, you know, covered in the headlines that often. They can be, but often they're behind closed doors and people aren't, there's not a lot of press coverage for them. So I don't know that they would necessarily be on the radar screen of any particular president. So I think it would be very hard to make that showing.
Thank you.
And again, I don't think there's anything in the Fifth Circuit's cases or the Supreme Court's cases that support that. Collins was a rewind agency action case. CFSA was as well. Calcutt in the Sixth Circuit was also a rewind agency action case. The Supreme Court, however, in Axon and in other cases like Thomas versus Union Carbide, has recognized that the injury of appearing before a constitutionally improper forum is a distinct and independent injury from the adverse ruling that that forum might issue. And so here we are attempting to avoid that first injury of a constitutionally improper forum. And whether or not we succeed or not before the ALJ is immaterial to that claim. This kind of dovetails with the irreparable injury point. I think Mr. Bem said that the board's current lack of a quorum at the very outset of his argument prohibits us from, or prevents us from making an irreparable injury showing because the board doesn't have a quorum. I didn't hear any statement that the removal of Member Wilcox was legally sound in the board's view. And in fact, Member Wilcox has filed a lawsuit today in the D.C. District Court to challenge it. So that's very much an issue that's going to have to be decided by the courts. But the key point here, I think, for the ALJ claim is my understanding is that the ALJ hearings continue onward, even when the board as a multi-member body lacks a quorum. And there have been times within the board's recent memory where it's lacked a quorum. I'm not aware of any indication by the current Office of Administrative Law Judges or anybody else at the board that ALJ hearings are on hold. So if the injunction here were gone, that ALJ hearing could go back on the calendar any time. So this is very much still a live controversy, and we would still be irreparably harmed if that ALJ hearing took place.
If we did find irreparable harm here, would that put us in conflict or tension with Second Circuit, Sixth Circuit, Tenth Circuit?
So not in the Second Circuit or Sixth Circuit. Both of those cases involving the CFPB and the FDIC were the Collins CFSA kind of case, where after the agency proceeding has taken place, the party doesn't like the result that the agency reached, tries to get it set aside. So there's no tension at all. The Tenth Circuit case is a little more complicated. I still think there's no tension, because in the Tenth Circuit, the Court of Appeals limited the potential injury that had been preserved for its consideration on appeal to the purely constitutional injury and said, we're not going to consider potential reputational harm or the costs of undergoing these proceedings because you didn't make that argument in the district court. Now, I think that the Tenth Circuit was wrong about whether that constitutional injury, which is, again, the here and now injury that the Supreme Court has time and time recognized, constitutes enough of an injury. But I would note that other piece here is present in the record. Every employer submitted a declaration in the trial court and made the argument about the concrete harms of these NLRB proceedings in addition to the legal harm of an unconstitutional proceeding. Of course, the Tenth Circuit in the Leachco case then went on to disagree with this court's Jarkissi ruling. So obviously there's already a bit of attention there, if not outright disagreement, but you know, under the rule of orderliness, the Jarkissi decision here still remains binding precedent. On irreparable injury, I think that the key to irreparable injury is, as this court put it in Louisiana versus Biden, not so much the magnitude, but the irreparability. That's what counts. And an injunction, especially a preliminary injunction, maintains the status quo to preserve the court's ability to provide meaningful relief at final judgment. And that is what the district courts here explained the injunction was necessary to do, relying quite reasonably on Axon and Cochran. Because Axon, again, says that this injury, this here and now injury, is impossible to remedy once the proceeding is over. To me, that's the definition of an irreparable injury. I don't see any daylight there between those two concepts. Also, this court has generally recognized constitutional harms as sufficient for a preliminary injunction in the BST Holdings case involving OSHA's vaccination mandate emergency temporary standard. The court there said that the loss of constitutional freedoms for even minimal periods of time unquestionably constitutes irreparable injury. That was not a First Amendment case. That was a case about liberty and the ability to reject a vaccination that you didn't want to receive. And then just last year, the court recognized in Career Colleges and Schools of Texas versus Department of Education that being subjected, quote, to costly and unlawful, in this case, administrative adjudications amounts to irreparable harm. So you wouldn't be breaking any new ground here in holding with the district courts that there was irreparable harm. On the final two factors, in a case like this against the federal government, those two factors merge, balance of equities and public interest. And the law of the circuit is clear that there is generally no public interest in the perpetuation of unlawful agency action. That's a quote from Louisiana versus Biden once more. And I don't mean to denigrate or minimize the importance of the board's mission under the National Labor Relations Act. And that's obviously a big concern of the defendants here. But I do want to argue that that mission can't override the Constitution's requirements. The federal government can and must comply with the Constitution in pursuing its statutory objectives, even if constitutional compliance is less efficient, convenient, or useful. And again, that's a quote from Free Enterprise Fund and Boucher versus Sinar. Enforcing the separation of powers is itself in the public interest because the separation of powers is critical to preserving the liberty of the people as a whole. And in this case, vital to ensuring that the executive remains accountable for the actions taken by the executive branch. As Chief Justice Roberts put it in Free Enterprise Fund, the buck has to stop with the president, not somewhere else. And that is the principle that's at stake in this case. Unless the court has other questions, I don't think that the court needs to reach the second issue on NLRB members' removal protections in order to affirm. Only one of the district courts reached that question. And here, I think the relief was the same in all three cases, an injunction of a specific proceeding until final judgment. So I think it's fully sufficient to address the ALJ removal protection issue. And we also don't think that the court needs to or really should address severability because that is a question in fashioning declaratory relief, which is something that's available only at final judgment. And just for the record, I think the severability question here is really hard because you have two layers of removal protection that combine to impose the injury, and figuring out which of the layers Congress would have wanted to jettison is quite tricky. The board cites the NLRA's severability provision, which would affect the upper layer of removal protection, I guess to suggest that Congress's intent more supports severing the board members' removal protections than the ALJ's. And it is true that the APA was very consciously focused on providing independence for administrative law judges. That was a deliberate shift from the hearing examiners that predated the APA, as Justice Breyer noted in his Lucia concurrence. So I think that the severability problems here are tough, but that the court doesn't need to reach them to affirm.
Is there a separate SpaceX v. NLRB appeal before another merits panel coming up soon, like next week?
There is a separate SpaceX versus NLRB appeal involving separate NLRB proceedings against SpaceX. Okay. It has already been argued.
Okay.
It is in a different posture because in that case, appellate jurisdiction is premised on the effective denial of a preliminary injunction. And that case was argued back in November. The board argues that it should be dismissed for lack of appellate jurisdiction, and we have not received a decision from that panel.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Unless the court has any other questions, we would ask that you affirm.
Okay. Mr. Keneally, thanks. Mr. Bem, you have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
I'll first address the Norris LaGuardia Act points. The appellees rely on the Wooten case, which was a 1983 case, where the court found that this court found that an injunction against peace officers restricting picketing was permissible under Norris LaGuardia. In that case, the injunction was in support of the policies in Section 102 of the Norris LaGuardia Act. It was not contrary to them. And the Armco case discusses this distinction. Similarly, in Armco, it involved an injunction against certain activities in a labor dispute premised on 1983. But in that case, the injunction would inhibit the union, in that case's ability to assert its interest in a labor dispute, and that distinction made all the difference there. So injunctions that are consistent with Norris LaGuardia are permissible if there's some other authority for them, such as 1983. And the Ninth Circuit case, Reuter v. Skipper, similarly found that where, in that case, I believe it was a public employee was challenging his dismissal under 1983 grounds. And that because 1983 was a separate statutory authority, that there was jurisdiction under 1983 and that it didn't offend the spirit or letter of 102. I wanted to address the point about 104 being an exclusive list. That decision, or that the text of Norris LaGuardia is clear that Section 101 creates the broad prohibition, and it is jurisdictional on courts using the injunctive power to interfere in you know, against the interest of employees in a labor dispute. It's set forth in a separate section, an enumerated list of things, whether done singly or in concert, that are not subject to injunctive relief, but that is not an exclusive list. We have multiple courts have held that Section 101 is the sort of universal provision, and 104 is the exemplars of the worst abuses. In 1930, Justice Frankfurter, before he was a justice, wrote a book with Nathan Green called The Labor Injunction that detailed I have a copy of the book at home, it's a tome, the different ways courts had enjoined collective employee action. And this was a response to particular types of what were seen as abuses by the judiciary. So the D.C. Circuit explained this in the Marine Engineers case, and I believe the Ninth Circuit also has held that this is not an exclusive list. It's also just inconsistent with the nature of this broad. As the Supreme Court has described it, a broad restriction on the injunctive power. So the mine workers case my friend mentioned, that was involved the War Labor Disputes Act. And in that case, the mines had been seized by the government. So he was correct in that case that the government as an employer was not a person subject to Norris LaGuardia. So it just has nothing to do with what's going on here. I would also note this court's decision in the Bishop case involved an injunction directed to a United States Marshal. So this court clearly has contemplated that injunctions against government actors come within North LaGuardia. The Armstrong decision of the Supreme Court also makes clear that judge-made remedies are subject to statutory limitations. And in this case, judge-made remedies, and in that case as well, to enforce to enforce constitutional claims. With respect to the, and I only have a little bit of time left, I guess I'll limit my discussion to Leachco and those cases. Three circuit courts have flatly rejected the theory of causal harm that are advanced by these folks. The Yap decision in the Sixth Circuit, Leachco out of the Tenth Circuit, and the Alpine securities litigation out of the D.C. Circuit. But that forecloses any success on the merits here, and this court should not invite a circuit split on that issue.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate the arguments of counsel on both sides, and the case is submitted, and the court will stand adjourned.